sort of changes. I've also provided you in your packets a section-by-section summary of Senate Bill 528 that just goes through each of the sections and just briefly describes the content. I note that that summary, though, is based on the Dash 9, that is the retroactive version of this bill, and the Dash 8 does not have sections 21, 22, and 23 in it, because all three of those sections have to do with retroactive application and what sort of notice a defendant on resentencing gets in a retroactive application.
Okay, so the Dash 9s are retroactive, and the Dash 8s are not retroactive. And, committee, by retroactive, we mean only applying to those cases that are somewhere in the system now. It does not, it would not, the retroactive version would not apply to cases that have already been exhausted all their remedies, that have already been completed. Or if someone has exhausted all their appeals and they're in prison or wherever, then the retroactive version would not apply to them. What it would apply to is cases that perhaps are being challenged now under Blakely and are in the process of being challenged. And so that's the policy discussion that we really didn't get into in any kind of depth when we had the hearing. And I wanted to have a discussion of that before we decide which of these approaches to take. There are strong arguments on both sides, which we will hear about. And we have at least 9 people I want to hear from. 3 of them are from the prosecutor point of view, 3 from the judicial point of view, and 3 from the defense bar point of view. And that pretty much encompasses the points of view we had in our work group, of which I was a member, to come up with this fix in the first place. So I think we'll start off with the with the prosecutor point of view, Brad Berry, Tim Sylvester, and Chuck French. And if there's somebody else who needs to come up, we could pull up another chair. Welcome to the committee. You're free to comment on other aspects of the Dash 8 and the Dash 9 amendments, but I really want to focus this discussion on retroactive versus not retroactive. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Brad Berry. I'm the Yamhill County District Attorney, and I also am the chair of the ODAA Legislative Committee, the District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. I might address just one comment on something that Mr. O'Leary said that I clarified with Mr. Sylvester, that in the same number of jurors agreeing on the enhancement factor, it need not be the If you had 11-1, for example, voting for guilt, you still would only need 10 of the 11 to vote for the enhancement factor in order for it to work. It doesn't need to be the exact same number of jurors. It just has to be the same jurors with no less than 10. At least that's as I read it. So it's a technical factor, but I wanted to be sure that the record was at least complete, that that was the intent of the of that provision.
Let me get a on the record from counsel. Is that your understanding?
Madam Chair, I think that actually what Mr. Berry is pointing out was a flaw in an earlier version of this package, that Judge Barron from Coos County, after reviewing that, pointed out to me just a few days ago. And I think Mr. Berry is absolutely correct. There's a case from the Oregon Supreme Court, State versus Boots, that strongly suggests that not only the same number of jurors need to agree to the enhancement as agreed to guilt, but the same jurors need to agree. And that is the instructions I gave to Virginia Vanderbilt and Legislative Council pursuant to Judge Barron's suggestion. And that is now, I think, encompassed in, I'm actually scanning my index that I thought would make it very easy.
Seven three.
Thank you. I think that language is now adequately provided in section 7 sub 3. And then there is also, in the retroactive version of this, the point was made by Jean Ann Quinn that there could be a conflict. If we do adopt the retroactive version of this bill, there would be cases that are coming back to the trial court on remand that will result in a resentencing where it would be impossible for the same jurors who agreed to guilt to agree to the enhancement fact for sentencing, because those original jurors are long gone. So there is language that Virginia Vanderbilt inserted just this morning into the dash 9 that takes that into account in sections 22 and 23, so that it is clear that it is the number of jurors that must agree to get a conviction that must agree to the enhancement if we're talking about a case that's on remand for resentencing.
Madam Chair, if I might.
As we're sitting here looking at this again in Section 7, I actually think it overstates the Boots position. In other words, we know that in a felony, only 10 of 12 jurors must agree to convict. And as this reads, it currently it says, and I quote, unless at least the same jurors who found the defendant guilty of the crime find that the state has met its burden of proof, end quote. So again, back to my illustration, that you could have a unanimous verdict of guilt, and constitutionally, and in conformance with how we do subcategories currently, only 10 of 12 would need to vote to find the enhancement factor. The issue on Boots is if we had an 11-1 vote for guilty, 10 of those 11 would have to agree on the enhancement factor, which you would not then be required to have 11 or 12 wouldn't be in that scenario. You wouldn't be required to have 11 to find the enhancement factor. I think Section 7 tends to read that you would have to have 11 to find the enhancement, and that would be contrary to kind of what we do now. I don't think that's the intended consequence, and that's not what Boots says. I can see the committee counsel is, that I've explained it so well that I'm crossing his eyes. My point being that if, in fact, only 10 of 12 are necessary for guilt, then I think only 10 of 12 are necessary to find an enhancement factor.
Mm-hmm.
Boots would say those 10 must be included in the 11 if you had an 11-1 guilty verdict, so that the one who voted not guilty could now not say yes to enhancement. And I don't believe that Section 7 states that as it's written. I think that was the intent, but I don't think that's how it's currently worded.
Senator Brzezinski.
So for the record on the Boots, whatever 10 made that decision as to guilt will always have to be on the enhancement, and you could always add one or two more if they chose to participate with a yes to the enhancement.
Madam Chair, Senator Brzezinski, I think that's correct.
But you couldn't have someone who voted no on the guilt be counted among your tally for the yes on the enhancement.
That's correct.
All right.
Well unless it's over 10.
Yeah.
Right. As long as you had the same 10, correct?
Exactly. I mean, if you needed, I think we know what we're saying. If you needed the number, it had to be someone who also voted guilty in the guilt phase.
Correct.
To vote for the enhancement.
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. I guess this is how this is going to work then, and I agree with you. I don't think sub 3 says that. I think it's not worded correctly. But if you end up with a 10-2 vote, so you now have the two members who cannot go to the enhancement phase, would those two members then be released and not involved in the jury deliberations when it gets to the enhancement phase of the trial?
No, Madam Chair and Senator Beyer, I would envision it that it would occur that the two who voted not guilty would be part of the deliberations for the enhancement. However, their vote would become irrelevant at the time of the enhancement vote, because all 10 of those who found the defendant guilty would have to agree on the enhancement or it would fail.
100%.
Well, follow-up. It seems like this happens simultaneously, or is this a separate, this a simultaneous trial or a separate trial?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, it depends. If the enhancement factor is one that is deemed to go to the conduct, to the crime, it is submitted to the jury simultaneously with the guilt portion. If it is deemed an enhancement that goes to the offender, for example, persistent involvement in similar offenses in the past, then that would be submitted to the jury in a subsequent hearing post a finding of guilt.
Well, it seems that in that second scenario, it would be as a detriment to have those jurors who voted against the guilt in the room, because they could try to sway deliberations and keep the enhancement from happening.
No, but that's
I think that's true. That's exactly right. But I would actually take to the next step and ask Mr. Berry, if those two individuals who are excluded from that second set of deliberation as to the enhancement based on the person, wouldn't we actually be running into another problem, because you've actually now separated your jury? I think they have the right to participate because they can make their arguments as to why that should not be enhanced. But the reality, their vote to not or to their vote is really irrelevant, because you still got to get those same 10 that found guilt to agree to the enhancement.
And it's, it's also possible that somebody who was not convinced of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt can be very convinced of the enhancement factors beyond a reasonable doubt. In other words, they may be very convinced that someone was a persistent involvement in crime or one of those offender-related factors, and might help to sway the jury. The test is a jury of your peers.
Madam Chair, I might point out that as the three of us are whispering back and forth, we all concur that that would be the required process for appropriate deliberations.
Counsel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Berry, I want to go back to 7-3 and make sure I understand this juror count issue. As I was kind of thinking it through in my head, the issue is you want to avoid a situation where it could be that 11 of the 12 jurors vote guilty, and under this sub 3, it would be required that 11 of the 12 then have to agree to the enhancement factor be proved, and it should only be 10 of the 11.
Yes, I think it could be corrected as we've kind of been seeing here. If it was just changed to read, an enhancement fact that is tried to a jury is not proven unless at least 10 of the same jurors who found the defendant guilty of the crime find that the state has met its burden.
Okay, thank you. We can make that change, and is if we put at least 10, are all of the trials going to have that same threshold? I mean, because some trials will...
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. misdemeanors have 6 jurors and would not be subject to aggravating factors on a felony. I suppose there is the possibility that a defendant and state could agree to waiving to 6 jurors on a felony. That's legally permissible. It doesn't really happen very often. And I don't turn to my colleagues. It could...
No, I think what we need to say here is just to say that... That's the same jurors, that of the required number, the same jurors had to have had voted in the guilty case. I think we can fix it issuing a number.
Yes, Madam Chair, if it was waived to a 6-person jury, that's a unanimous verdict that is required.
Yeah.
And so if, in fact, you want to be sure that that's included, it is a slightly different...
Well, we just need to make reference of it without mentioning a specific number, but thank you for pointing that out. I missed that myself. Okay, so on the subject of retroactivity, before we get past this, any other questions on this point? On the issue of retroactivity, then.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if I might, I've had the good fortune of sharing emails with my colleagues, both Mr. Spester and others, and we've discussed at length, I think, the issue of retroactivity. And if I might just offer some points that I think are salient to the committee on the issue, we would favor the -9 amendments, which would allow for retroactivity of both those matters which are currently on appeal or cases which might be remanded to the trial court by post-conviction relief.
First off, it seems when we're looking at the issue of cost, and I know that's part of the committee's concern, that many of these cases that would be returned to the trial court will likely be negotiated out. The parties on both sides will figure out an appropriate way, go back before the court, and they will negotiate it. In other words, I wouldn't expect that just because a matter is remanded on a Blakely issue that we then would be impaneling a jury to try that. So that's a significant portion of the cases, I believe, that would be kind of cut out of the overall cost, and the matter will come back before a judge. Most of us already believe that on these cases that are being returned to us, that we have the authority to ask the court to impanel a jury to look at the sentencing issue anyway, much like occurs when an aggravated murder sentence is remanded to the trial court. And although there is no statutory procedure specifically allowing that, there is none that prohibits that. And currently, I would take that position in my office, and we would argue that to the court. A designated procedure, as set forth in Senate Bill 528, is one that will take the guesswork out of it. In other words, the designated procedure will likely cause less litigation in the long run than if we are, in fact, at the trial court level, again, having to litigate whether we may or may not impanel a jury to hear the sentencing issue. If we leave it up in the air, I too believe that you may have defendants who, rather than negotiate to get the case resolved and get it moving and completed, might actually dig in their heels and refuse to negotiate. In other words, they'll want to do battle as to whether or not a jury can be impaneled and fight it all the way through, whereas otherwise, if in fact the procedure is in place, they'll just work towards resolution in many cases to get that done. And certainly, I think it is better policy from the legislature to say, here is a procedure which we're giving you to work with, rather than leaving it up to individual trial courts, court by court, making the decision throughout the state. I know, issues have been raised about the constitutionality, whether in fact this creates an ex post facto issue for us. And I will leave to Mr. Sylvester to deal with the legal part of that. But at least in our discussions, they think that that is not a likely scenario that that would pose the problem. In fact, as I understand it, and again, I think Tim can address this better than I, it may actually pose a constitutional problem by not setting up the process for these cases that are remanded. And as I understand it, that's an equal protection issue. Those in the system today are being treated different than those in the system who are coming back to the trial court, one having the opportunity to have a jury hear it, the other not. So that may, in fact, by not establishing the procedure, a process whereby these cases are dealt with, may, in fact, create the constitutional problem. I genuinely think that Senate Bill 528 needs to be set up to deal with all sentencing issues. Those are before the trial court currently and those that come back to the trial court on remand. Lastly, I think it's an issue of fairness. If, in fact, the procedure, if you do not provide for a procedure, on retroactive procedure for these people coming back, one of several things is going to happen. If the court were to determine that we can't impanel a jury to hear the issues of aggravating factors, then in fact convicted criminals will receive a windfall on their sentence that an aggravating factor cannot be applied to them. They'll get that windfall by coming back, and by necessity their sentences may be shortened. These are the worst offenders that we see. The circumstances, the low percentage of cases where in fact the court imposes a departure sentence, it's a low number. And so these are our worst offenders now that would come back and receive this windfall. It would also include those who get remanded to us after having been found by the court to be dangerous offenders. Those cases, too, will be coming back to us, and without a procedure in place for that designation to be found by a jury trial, we run the risk of releasing those individuals further. I would suggest to you that there's no rational basis to give those who have already been convicted and sentenced a better sentence or a windfall on their time that they are required to serve because we don't establish an appropriate process.
Other questions from the committee? If something did come back to you, and I'll be asking the others as well, but given that it's a U.S. Supreme Court decision and something came back to you on remand, and you went ahead and used a process, even though the Blakely fix was not retroactive, you used a process that you felt complied with it, in maybe even the actual provisions of the bill. Does that have any precedent, and would you do you feel that you would be able to prevail on that if it was challenged?
I might defer that to
okay,
Mr.
we'll wait until Mr. Sylvester.
I think we would prevail, Madam Chair, but I think Mr. Sylvester is in a better position to
okay.
talk about that.
We'll hold that question for Mr. Sylvester. Thank you. Why don't you go ahead?
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Tim Sylvester, Department of Justice, Criminal Justice Division. I concur on Mr. Bradbury's comments. A couple of things I wanted to add, and that is that it's still unclear now just precisely how big of a problem this is. The Oregon Supreme Court just allowed review in one of the cases, the Blakely cases, and I think the court is going to be addressing the issue of whether cases in which the defendant failed to preserve a challenge in the trial court are ones in which the defendant is going to be entitled to relief. If the court says if it's not preserved then you don't get relief, then that will cut down substantially on the number of cases going back. However, if the court, if Supreme Court agrees with the Court of Appeals on this, I think my best guess of the number of cases that may be going back just on the direct appeal route could be several hundred. And so add to that the possibility that we could have hundreds of these cases going back if post-conviction relief is granted on these kind of claims. There was a case out of the Oregon Supreme Court just today that suggests that perhaps there will not be post-conviction relief in these cases, but if the court ultimately concludes otherwise, we may end up with quite a few cases going back for remanded for resentencing in post-conviction cases. And then
run that by again. You said the court indicated that post-conviction would not be sent back?
Well, today the Oregon Supreme Court in a case called Burge versus Palmateer, I believe, said that it wasn't a Blakely case, it was another case, but the court said that a counsel is not to be found to be constitutionally inadequate simply for failing to anticipate a major change in the law. And so arguably that same rule would apply in this situation, and a lot of defendants who were sentenced previously to departure sentences are not going to be able to get post-conviction relief now based on a claim that their counsel should have raised this sort of objection at sentencing. That's what we're hoping. But it could well be that the court won't apply Burge to Blakely cases. And so that's a big unknown, whether we're going to get cases remanded by post-conviction courts. And then we have this whole third group of cases, and that is outside the context of aggravating factors, what does Blakely apply to? And that may be, for example, findings for consecutive sentences. The statute now requires the court to make certain findings in order to impose consecutive sentences, and one of the great unanswered questions in the current fight over this is whether that particular statute is subject to Blakely. If the Court of Appeals determines that consecutive sentences are subject to Blakely, we may have a whole huge other group of cases going back for resentencing. And so I just want to tell you that this is a rather substantial issue, whether we're going to end up having to be allowed to resentence people under the current statute if Blakely applies to them. Mr. Berry is correct that the people who are most affected by this particular issue are the most dangerous of offenders, people who have been determined to be dangerous offenders, people who have received upward departure sentences, people who have been sentenced to consecutive sentences. Those are the group of people that the sentencing courts out there around the state over the last several years have been determining are the most dangerous and require the longest sentences. If those sentences are set aside and the court on remand cannot be sentenced to an enhanced sentence, what that will be is a windfall, not just for defendants, but a windfall for the most serious of defendants. It is our belief that allowing for a impaneling of juries and a resentencing in accordance with this statute will not present problems under either the Double Jeopardy Clause or the Ex Post Facto Clause. I will advise the Court that there currently is a case that is pending before the Oregon Supreme Court. It's on a petition for writ of mandamus. It's the Sirotsky case out of Multnomah County, where the defendant is being resentenced in Multnomah County after being remanded, and he is arguing that he can't be resentenced because of the Double Jeopardy Clause and the Ex Post Facto Clause, and the trial court has disagreed with him. And anyway, he has petitioned the Oregon Supreme Court. So I think that it's probably a good bet that the Supreme Court will pick that case up. If it picks that case up, I think we will get these particular constitutional issues resolved relatively quickly, and then we will know whether or not these cases can be retried on remand. If the Oregon Supreme Court says the Double Jeopardy Clause precludes it, then you can't do the resentencing on remand, even if the statute allows it. But if the Supreme Court in that case says, yes, the Double Jeopardy Clause does not preclude remand, then it will be useful to us to have a statute in place that will allow that to happen. And so I think that through the cases that we have currently pending, we will be able to get those constitutional issues resolved.
Could you tell me again what that case is? It's pending in the Supreme Court now?
Yes, it's S-A-W-A-T-Z-K-Y, Sawatsky, Sawatsky.
Sawatsky versus?
Well, State of Oregon versus Sawatsky, okay. Sawatsky, S-A-W-A-T-Z-K-Y.
Okay.
Anyway, the Supreme Court has not yet allowed that petition, but we have responded and suggested to the court that they do allow the petition and get and have the issue resolved on the merits.
Okay.
And given the fact that both parties are asking for it, I think the court will probably grant
and,
it.
And if they do adjudicate this one way or the other, that you feel that this will cover all of the circumstances,
the constitutional objections to a retrial on remand, I believe that will be true. And it also will present the issue that Mr. Berry and you were talking about earlier, and that is, in the absence of the statute, does current Oregon law allow for this sort of jury impanelment to decide aggravating factors? That's the issue. That's one of the issues in that case, too, because we don't yet have the statute in place. But anyway, I think that that is an issue that we expect will be resolved soon by the Oregon Supreme Court. I think that covers the points I wanted to make, unless the committee has questions for me.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Mr. French, next.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. My name is Chuck French. I'm a Deputy District Attorney in Multnomah County. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you once again about this issue. As I understood from the committee, the information that I had were there on this retroactivity issue. There were three concerns. The first was the constitutionality, and I believe and Mr. Sylvester has covered that very well here. I don't believe personally that we will ultimately have a constitutional problem with this. The second issue was the financial impact that this might have, and the third issue was the matter of public policy. I'd like to just address the final issue, public policy, first, and again reiterate that the type of cases we are talking about here are the cases that are the most dangerous offenders in Oregon. People who have been convicted of a crime that a judge has determined should either merit an upward departure for certain reasons, or worse than that, that they are sexually dangerous offenders, or dangerous offenders, and warrant, even though they may have only a prison sentence of, say, 70 months or less, but they warrant up to 30 years because of psychological profiles, prior records, prior history, the nature of the crime. They merit being qualified as a dangerous offender under the supervision of the Corrections Division for up to 30 years in the parole board. So what we're dealing with here are in, as Mr. Berry said, giving a windfall or a pass to someone here whose case may have been remanded after a judge has had determined him to be a dangerous offender. We're not dealing with car thieves or even drug dealers. We're dealing with violent offenders, oftentimes, and certainly always in sexually dangerous offender and dangerous offender cases, who represent the most threat to our community and who may see a difference of 20 or 25 years in their sentence. It's possible that their sentence might only be 3 or 4 years to the state penitentiary, but because of a psychological profile, a judge has determined, and now a jury will have to determine under Blakely, that they merit a 30-year dangerous offender sentence. So this is the type of individual we're dealing with, at least one of the types of individuals we're dealing with here. So I think it's a significant issue that we have to understand here, that if we're simply going to close the books on those cases and allow them to serve the sentence, dangerous offenders and sexually dangerous offenders especially, the presumptive sentence that many of them will be getting out of custody either now or in a few short years. So as a public policy matter, I think that we need to consider this as one of the more significant issues we're going to deal with in concerning Blakely. The second issue that I wanted to talk to you about was the issue of financial impact. And I wanted to break that down into two separate areas. The first is the financial impact to the corrections division, because that is always a concern with bills that might deal with penitentiary sentences. I feel certain that this will not only have no additional financial impact to the corrections division, but it may, as to what they are paying now for these offenders, but it could only be less. The reason I say that is we have a number of people here who have been sentenced to the penitentiary. The only they cannot get greater sentences by being sent back to the court system. They can only get less sentences. If cases are submitted to a jury and a jury determines that the enhancement factors don't exist, their sentences that now can only be less than what they were before. So they cannot be greater, but only less. So it will have no financial impact on the corrections division. On the court system, it is conceivable that we will have a few more hearings in which juries will have to be impaneled. But again, my 24 years experience as a prosecutor leads me to believe that the vast majority of these cases, when they come back, will be resolved. And let me give you an instance, for instance here. It's conceivable that a person who has committed a car theft and has a record of car of unlawful use of a vehicle might have been given an upward departure of 18 months prior to Blakely. That upward departure now would have to come back and be presented either in front of a jury or waived to a judge. That 18-month sentence would then be available. The defendant would know full well that if the jury found that he had a persistent history of criminal involvement or some other factor, like was on probation, that one, last one is relatively simple to prove, that if a jury found that that happened, the judge is going to give him the 18 months again. It's a relatively certain situation for him, and I feel confident that most of those cases will result in some arrangement between prosecutors' offices to give him somewhat less than the 18 months, say 12 months, that will resolve the case. Again, that would be less time he would serve in the corrections division, and in fact, the rate of negotiation for cases in this state exceeds 90% of all cases are resolved by negotiation, and I don't have any reason to believe that the rate of cases resolved in this situation would be any less than that. So I think the financial impact to the court system would be minimal at best. And as Mr. Berry has said, were we to not have this procedure in effect, I think the financial impact would be even greater to the court system, because it would lead the defendant to believe that if he did not seek to resolve his case and he simply wanted to argue the legal issues without any statutory procedure in place, and that is the primary legal issue that is now in the state of Oregon, is there a statutory procedure in place to deal with this? If he had no statutory procedure in place to deal with this, I believe that would impel many defendants to litigate their resentencings to the hilt. And as a consequence, the financial impact to the court system, or at least the workload impact to the court system, would be even greater than a situation where there is some certainty on the part of the defendant that there is an appropriate procedure in place and that he should now negotiate his case with the state to see if he can get some of his time cut off his sentence. Those are essentially the issues I wanted to raise. The third issue of constitutionality has been dealt with more than adequately, and it's about all I'd have to say. Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Before this panel leaves, Mr. Sylvester, if the state of Oregon versus Sawatzky does not go to the state Supreme Court and we do go retroactive on this Blakely fix, are you confident that you could successfully defend an ex post facto or a double jeopardy challenge to this?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I am loath to guarantee a result in any criminal case, particularly involving issues of constitutional magnitude. But the position, we have spent a lot of time talking about this internally at the Department of Justice, and our position is that that this is not a double jeopardy problem and this is not an ex post facto problem. There is a U.S. Supreme Court case, Doebert versus Florida, that was decided many years ago where the U.S. Supreme Court said that the it does not present an ex post facto problem to enact a new statute, to apply it retroactively, to fix a procedural problem in the original statute, which is all we have here, is a procedural problem in the original statute. The Oregon Court of Appeals has followed the Doebert case in a couple of cases since then. The Oregon Supreme Court has not yet addressed that particular issue under the state constitution, but we're reasonably sure that we will win that particular ex post facto issue. I also don't believe it's a double jeopardy problem because the defendant the first time around, in fact, was tried and convicted for the aggravated offense, and so the only problem was a procedural problem in the manner in which that trial was had. A remand for a new trial with the enhanced procedure isn't a double jeopardy problem. At least I'm not aware of any case that has held that such a thing is a double jeopardy problem. But that is an issue that we're going to need to litigate over the next few years.
Thank you. Are there other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We are going to temporarily close the public hearing on Senate Bill 528. We'll come back to it in just a moment. And we are going to open a work session on Senate Bill 301. And we have heard testimony on the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 301. And I'm looking for a motion to send this to the Budget Committee with a due pass recommendation. Senator Starr.
Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 301.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 301. Is there any discussion? I think you raised your hand first.
Chair Burdick, I would object to that on two levels. First, procedurally, we really haven't had time to go through 18 pages of Attorney General's opinion regarding the Dash 2 amendments. And on the second part, on the bill itself, the changes in the grand jury proceedings and disclosure are widely unaccepted in our district by law professionals, and I would oppose the bill on that basis.
Okay, objection noted. Senator Beyer?
He just said what I was going to say.
Okay, I appreciate that. Dale, would you call the... Senator Starr has moved the Dash 2 amendments. Would you please call the roll on the Dash 2 amendments?
Senator Beyer?
No.
Senator Pruszynski?
Aye.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Whitsitt?
No.
Vice Chair Starr?
Aye.
Chair Burdick?
Aye. Dash 2 amendments are adopted. Senator Starr?
Move Senate Bill 301 is amended to Ways and Means with
Senate Budget Committee.
Oh, Senate. That's right. Senate Budget Committee.
We have our own committee now.
We wish it were Ways and Means, but it is in fact the Senate Budget Committee.
Will it do pass?
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 301 as amended to the Senate Budget Committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objection?
Madam Chair.
Oh, Senator Pazansky.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I just want to put on the record, I supported adopting the Dash 2s as Senator Wissett and Senator Beyer have alluded. We're moving this pretty quickly. I've not had a chance to check back with my local officials, both rank and file of the departments as well as the management. I know there were some concerns when the first bill was brought before us as to what process was going to be required at the local level since we already have some mechanisms in place. I've asked my staff today to fax the material down to one of the departments for review. I will support the motion to move it to budget, but I do reserve the right to change my position if it comes out of budget for a vote on the floor.
I appreciate you putting on that that on the record, Senator Pazansky, and to the committee, I apologize for the rapid movement. It's a function of it being mid-May, and this will be subject to another layer of analysis in our body, and I encourage you all to participate. So, Dale, would you call the roll?
Senator Beyer?
No.
Senator Pazansky?
Aye.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Wissett?
No.
Vice Chair Starr?
Aye.
Chair Burdick?
Aye.
Five ayes, two nays.
Senate Bill 301 as amended is passed to the Senate Budget Committee with a due pass recommendation. Thank you for your patience, audience. We will now reopen the work session on Senate Bill 528. And our next panel will be from the Defense Bar, Pete Gartland, Greg Silver, and John Hummel.
Madam Chair, I'll be sitting back. We'll just be these two
guys. That's fine. Thank you. Welcome. Why don't you start, Pete? Welcome.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peter Gartland. I'm with the Legal Services Division of the Office of Public Defense Services, and I thank you for the opportunity to address the committee with respect to retroactivity. Mr. Silver will be addressing double jeopardy and ex post facto. I've submitted a written piece of testimony concerning yet another potential problem with a retroactivity clause, and that is under state law. Under state law, there's decades-old law that says that if there's a material fact that can affect either a defendant's defense or the potential punishment, that fact has to be in the charging instrument. And so the problem with the retroactive application of this statute would be all the people who have already been tried and convicted and sentenced would now be faced with something that was not in the charging instrument. And it's very debatable whether or not that would satisfy Oregon law. And perhaps as a preface, I should have said, I hope you've heard this, but no one can guarantee whether or not the retroactive aspect of this statute would be constitutional. No criminal defense attorney will tell you that, whether it's from my side or the Attorney General's side. I mean, we have to remember why we're here in the first place. We're here because the U.S. Supreme Court came out with an incredible tidal wave decision that has influenced, affected a number of states. And incidentally, perhaps it's not all that relevant, but most of the states that do have the sentencing guidelines are trying to preserve a form of the sentencing guidelines. But back to the main point is no criminal defense attorney could ever tell you that this is guaranteed constitutional. The only thing that we know that is constitutional is not having the retroactive clause. That we know. There's no doubts about that. But with the retroactivity clause, I guarantee there will be litigation for years about whether or not criminal defendants can be forced to come back and face accusations, factual accusations, that have to be proven and proved beyond a reasonable doubt. I'd like to quickly address some of the comments by the prosecution side. I got the impression that I heard the word windfall several times, as if criminal defendants are having a windfall with respect to the Blakely decision. Well, as a matter of fact, in this state, most criminal defendants are still incarcerated. Most criminal defendants affected by Blakely are still incarcerated because the constitutionality of that sentence is still in the courts and still being decided. And as it stands now, those people are incarcerated under an illegal sentence. The U.S. Supreme Court has said that people cannot be incarcerated without a jury finding on all the facts necessary to have a particular sentence. So we have several hundred people who are right now incarcerated with an unconstitutional sentence. I also heard comments that this would affect the most serious offenders in the system. Actually, it doesn't. Measure 11 addresses the most serious offenders in our system. The sentencing guidelines affects the people below them. So it's the felony, B felonies and C felonies. The most serious offenders are incarcerated with mandatory sentences of at least 70 months. I know Mr. French was referencing dangerous offenders. Those are the most serious offenders, but that's a small group. We checked, and as of now, there are two Court of Appeals opinions out that have remanded or ordered the remand of two dangerous offenders. In our office, currently, in our pipeline that we know of, we have three other dangerous offender clients. And interestingly, four out of five of those dangerous offenders I just mentioned have underlying Measure 11 offenses. So at a minimum, those people will be doing 70 months. And if they have multiple offenses, I'm sure that district attorneys will be pressing for consecutive sentences. So we know at a minimum those people are facing 70 months. So I think just as a matter of policy and fiscal savings, it seems prudent not to insert the clause that is going to generate lots of litigation and affect hundreds of cases. If the committee was curious, part of our check, we found that there are 30 opinions that have come out that have reversed sentences because of Blakely. We have 120 that we know of that are in our office, and I would estimate that probably there are another 60 to 100 more of Blakely-affected cases. But again, those are sentencing guidelines cases. Those are not the most egregious offenders in the system. The most egregious offenders are the aggravated murderers and the dangerous offenders. Of those, I know of five, and of those, all but one has underlying Measure 11 offenses, convictions, so they would get at least 70 months.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Sullivan.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Gregory Silver. I'm a chief attorney with Metropolitan Public Defender Services in Portland. While I'm not speaking for my firm today, my comments are based on my experience as a criminal defense lawyer, and I do believe that my comments are echoed by the vast majority of criminal defense practitioners. Let me say that we in OCDLA, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, do fully support the current bill as written, with the exception of the retroactivity provisions. And I want to address why. First, as has been referenced, there are actually currently at least two mandamus petitions before the Oregon Supreme Court requesting that the court decide the issue of whether a trial court can impanel a sentencing jury on a case remanded for resentencing under Blakely. One of those petitions, State versus Upton, was filed by the state. State versus Sawatsky, was filed by the defense. And you should know that I am the trial counsel on State versus Sawatsky. I was the trial counsel when Ms. Sawatsky was sentenced, and it was actually a plea. And I may get into that if that would help the committee understand some of the processes that we're talking about. But she was sentenced back in 2001. Her case was appealed. The Court of Appeals, following the Blakely decision on September 8th of 2004, remanded her case for resentencing. We went in front of the, went back to the trial judge. The district attorney, Deputy DA in Multnomah County, said to the trial judge that he would be asking for the impaneling of a sentencing jury. The judge indicated that he was in favor of that. I requested the opportunity to brief and argue the issue. We did. The judge, following our arguments, said that he was more persuaded than he thought he'd be, but he wasn't there yet. And before I actually got the chance to tell him that I would be petitioning for mandamus, he essentially asked if I would be and said this would be a good way to get it resolved, so because at least this way we will have a decision. So I wanted you to know of my involvement, and while certainly, you know, so I do, while I do have a professional interest in advocating for my clients, I am not here on behalf of one client. My opposition to this, to the retroactivity, goes far beyond any individual case. The major fault of retroactivity is that it will be challenged, and I believe it is likely unconstitutional. I guess it's no surprise that I might disagree with my friends in the prosecution bar on that. But I think that the constitutionality will certainly be challenged by defendants who are given departure sentences, and I can foresee them under Article 1, Section 21, which is the ex post facto provision of the Oregon Constitution. And, of course, all of these will have their related federal counterparts, too. That may be, in many ways, the least important. Article 1, Section 20, dealing with equal privileges and immunities, and Article 1, Section 12, on double jeopardy, I think are the more likely ones. And there very likely could be other challenges as well. And those challenges, as Mr. Gartland had said, and I think it's accurate, will take years to resolve and will consume tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars of time and resources in their decision. The remanded cases, I think all of them, are subject to double jeopardy challenges. Now, a recent federal case from the District of Oregon, U.S. v. Kassab, discussed double jeopardy issues under an analysis known as initial jeopardy. In that case, the judge found that when the federal court had accepted a defendant's plea to an unspecified amount of a controlled substance, in other words, the defendant pled guilty to possessing a certain amount of some type of drug, I don't know what it was, it then lost the right to attempt to prove to a sentencing jury that he was responsible for a specified amount. The federal and state systems work somewhat differently, but the defendant had pled guilty to possessing the drug. And then following Blakely, the government wanted to come back and prove that he possessed X amount of the drug. That would have enhanced the sentence that he could receive for possessing an unspecified amount of the drug. And Judge Redden found that the state could not do that because that would be double jeopardy, because jeopardy had already attached to that crime when the defendant had entered his initial plea. That same analysis applies to why it would be unconstitutional to allow the state to impanel a sentencing jury to decide aggravating factors which were not pled or proven initially. And the reason is because the factors that were used to enhance the sentence are no longer factors. And I think that's why the double jeopardy analysis here is far different than any previous double jeopardy analysis. Apprendi came out actually 5 years ago next month, the end of June of 2000. It's taken us about 5 years, and there have been a few intervening U.S. Supreme Court decisions, and the Oregon Court of Appeals and Supreme Court have interpreted the Apprendi and then the Blakely decisions that the Blakely following Apprendi after that. But what we know now, as we understand what the court meant by elements of a crime and the fact that a person could not be sentenced to more than the maximum without a jury determination on that, is that anything that increases the sentence beyond the prescribed statutory maximum, which we know in Oregon as our gridlock, is an element of the crime. If you look at footnote 19, I believe it is, in Apprendi, and it's explained more in more detail in Justice Thomas's concurring opinion, we know that these are elements of the crime. So essentially, when a person comes back for a resentencing under Blakely, the jury would be looking at additional elements of the crime for which this person has already been convicted. Now, I'm not going to argue the Sawatsky case to you, but I think that that might be illustrative, and it may help you understand, because the cases that are coming back are not really all the worst of the worst. As Mr. Gartland said, the worst of the worst are the Measure 11 offenders, and the Measure 11 sentences are not affected by eliminating retroactivity from this bill. In Ms. Sawatsky's case, Ms. Sawatsky pled guilty to a number of counts of aggravated theft and forgery. She had been employed as a bookkeeper at a construction company. She was accused of and pled guilty to embezzling money from that construction company. She was accused of embezzling somewhere, I believe it was around $500,000 from the construction company. Yes. When she pled guilty, she pled to, I believe it was $91,000, because the language in the indictment for aggravated theft said that she was accused of stealing $10,000 or more in each particular count. And we pled to $10,000 or more. Had we gone to trial, we would have contested the amount that she was accused of embezzling. But we pled because she was admitting to embezzling some of what she was accused of. At the sentencing hearing, Judge Gernanth in Multnomah County, as he was sentencing Ms. Sawatsky, asked Deputy DA Karen Immergut, and this was, I believe, one of her last cases before she left the DA's office to go to the U.S. Attorney's office and is now the U.S. Attorney for Oregon, he would ask Ms. Immergut, well, how much is alleged in this count? And she would say $35,210.94 or something like that. Judge Gernanth would say, well, I find that's harm greater than typical, and upward depart her. So he essentially upward departed every single count that he sentenced her on and gave her a sentence of 100 months in prison. The presumptive sentence would have been between 44 and 60, depending upon how you read the sentencing guidelines.
But did he do consecutive sentences in that case?
Yes, he did consecutive sentences on each count where it was possible. In that case, counts 1 and 2 were the same criminal episode, essentially. She was charged with the aggravated theft in count 1 and a forgery in count 2 because they alleged that the forgery, writing the checks that she was not supposed to, was the way that she committed the aggravated theft. So they were essentially the same crime, but it alleged different time periods over, I think it was a three-plus-year time period. So, yes, he did impose consecutive sentences. We've never challenged those consecutive sentences. What we challenged in the Court of Appeals was the upward departure that was not based on anything that was found by a jury or admitted by the defendant or proven beyond a reasonable doubt. That was the basis of the challenge in the Court of Appeals. And after Blakely came out, the Court of Appeals actually had this case for about a year. Whether they were waiting for the Blakely decision, I don't know. But after Blakely came out, the Court of Appeals issued their decision, and Sawatsky happened to be the first post-Blakely decision to come out of the Court of Appeals, and they remanded for resentencing because what Judge Gernanth used as the aggravating factors had not been admitted by Ms. Sawatsky and had not been found beyond a reasonable doubt. And that was you know, that was exactly what we did and why we did it. She admitted to what she did, not to what she didn't do. So in the Sawatsky case, you know, I think that that, you know, and again, I'm not arguing the case to you, but the Supreme Court, after Judge Grant, actually asked if I was going to be filing mandamus, and I said I was. We have filed mandamus. The state responded on April 29th. Actually, I see Ms. Lloyd there. Ms. Lloyd was on the response brief. The state agreed that our double jeopardy argument was a proper argument to put before the Supreme Court on mandamus. Now, I'm quite sure that Ms. Lloyd will not agree that, that double jeopardy applies. And she did not agree that with our other argument that the Judge Grenant at this time would have no authority to convene a sentencing jury. But that case is before the Supreme Court. There's another case in which the state filed a mandamus. It's a Baker County case, Eastern Oregon, where the judge there found that he did not have the right or the authority under Oregon law to impanel a sentencing jury. And in that case, the state filed a mandamus. That's State versus Upton. Both of those cases, I think the briefing in Upton may be complete now. You know, and of course we don't know when the Supreme Court will make a decision, but I would agree with Mr. Sylvester that the fact that both sides have asked them to decide the issue, you know, makes it more likely that they probably will. And once the Supreme Court decides that issue, that will be the most efficient, the speediest, and the best resolution to the issue of whether or not these cases can go in front of a judge who can then impanel a sentencing jury on remand.
But on the other hand, if we don't have the statutory structure for it, we won't have any basis to do that if the court rules in that direction.
Well, if the Supreme Court were to say that even though there is no specific statutory structure, that it is, you know, that the statutes don't preclude it, and if the Supreme Court were to say because it's not precluded, therefore you can't impanel a sentencing jury, then the judges will have the authority to impanel a sentencing jury. If the Supreme Court says there is no authority to impanel a sentencing jury, or because of double jeopardy, you can't impanel a sentencing jury, then we won't be able to impanel a sentencing jury. And that can all happen without the retroactivity portions of the bill being in the bill. That can happen as the law exists right now. So we don't need to put the retroactivity portions in the bill, because the Supreme Court can decide, and I assume will, you know, if they take the mandamus, they certainly will decide one way or the other what the courts can do or cannot do on remand.
But if the retroactivity was in the statute and the court ruled that it was double jeopardy or it was ex post facto, then those that retroactivity would be unenforceable. Isn't that correct?
Yes, but if it goes into the bill as giving the sentencing judges on remand the authority to impanel a jury, I'm going somewhat above my pay grade here in speculating on this. I don't know.
That's okay. We won't make it.
I don't know if that would affect the Supreme Court's decision, because, for instance, if the Supreme Court wanted to decide the issue on the authority right now of judges to impanel a sentencing jury, and this committee made that retroactive, then they might not address at that time the double jeopardy issue on mandamus. They might or might not. And in that case, then, the cases would come back. They'd go before a sentencing jury, and then we would appeal that on double jeopardy grounds if the departure factors were upheld. And that's how you get the cycle of litigation that's going down.
Okay. Chair. I think we're going to stop here. Senator Walker.
Yeah, thank you. I had a question because you're on the same track I am. Mr. Silver, I was reading your paper here, and you say that we should leave it to the court because there are presently two mandamus petitions before the Oregon Supreme Court. Let the court decide this matter. But what if the court refuses to accept those petitions? Then we're back where we started, and we'll be out of legislative session, and we won't be able to deal with this issue.
Well, if I would agree that you would not be able to deal with retroactivity at that point if it occurred when you were out of legislative session. But in terms of what of how the procedure would go, Senator Walker, and I appreciate the question. The if the Supreme Court decided not to address it, then the judges who felt that they had the authority to impanel a jury would impanel a jury, and those appeals would go forward, and at some point the Court of Appeals, those cases would get to the Court of Appeals would have to address it on appeal in some fashion. So even if retroactivity is left out of the bill, the Court of Appeals will eventually be addressing the issue, and then, you know, whichever side loses in the Court of Appeals could then appeal it to the Supreme Court.
All right.
Did I answer your question?
You answered my question perfectly. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Okay. Members, Chair Burdick, members.
Yes. Thank you. Now we'll go to our judicial panel. Judge Marcus, you've been very patient. Thank you very much. Jean Ann Quinn and Nancy Miller. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Michael Marcus. I'm a circuit court judge in Multnomah County, and I was in contact with Judge Julie Franz regularly and some of the others participating in the work group on Blakely, and I saw this issue percolating, and my simple perspective is there is going to be an issue which will be litigated until somebody resolves it at an appellate level in each and every one of these remanded cases, which is whether the trial court has the authority or not to impanel a jury. I have sympathies on both sides that you've just heard from, and I hate to annoy anybody, but I think I owe this committee my candid reflection on what's at stake here. The strongest argument that the defense bar has is that there's no authority to impanel a jury for this group of cases until this bill is effective. If this bill does not include the retroactivity provision, they've got their strongest argument. If they win that argument, as the defense did in Washington State recently at the state Supreme Court, then they don't reach any of those constitutional issues. Putting this provision in the bill does not deprive them of any of the constitutional issues they'd like to pursue, and they have every right to pursue them. I have my own views on it. My written testimony talks about ex post facto. I don't think there's a strong argument. I think if you ask them what their strongest argument is, they've got to concede that one of the strongest arguments is that there is no statute saying a judge has the authority to impanel a jury on remand for resentencing. And as far as the state Supreme Court resolving these issues for us, they expressly refused to do so in Dills. Dills was the case in which the Supreme Court said there is no Apprendi problem. Blakely was then decided, and Dills came back to the state Supreme Court. State Supreme Court sent back to trial judges. Okay, trial judges, deal with it, and we will not tell you how. What I'm trying to avoid is this simple situation in which we have anywhere, I say, upwards of 30. I know that's from what we know from what the appellate courts have already decided. I understand there may be 100, maybe 200. They may involve consecutive sentencing and so forth. Why should this body not express its policy as to whether it wants sentencing juries to be impaneled on cases on sentencing for remand? Clearly, this is the opportunity to do that. And this is not a question where anybody is trying to ask you to avoid or circumvent or affect a constitutional issue. It's clearly not a situation in which anyone's asking you to do something that is obviously or even strongly arguably unconstitutional, because making a set of new protections available to a defendant who already committed a crime at a time at which this enhanced penalty was on the books and for which people are still doing enhanced time because they're not affected by real retroactivity because their sentences are final. There is no argument anywhere that any of them can end up opening those sentences. They were sentenced to enhanced sentences exactly as these defendants were risking when they committed their crimes. All that's changed is they have now new rights. They have a choice between judge and jury, and they have burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. How is that unfair in any constitutional sense? Because ex post facto, in its classic sense, is making something either illegal that wasn't or more punishable when it was committed than when it was committed. And those things, those common fairness things, don't don't apply at all. I actually, my friends in defense bar will hate me for it, but I put windfall in my testimony too. That's what it is. Now, on the question of are these the most dangerous people, I'll give you some examples of cases coming back to my court. The relationship between ballot measure 11 and these sentences is that there are ballot measure 11 offenders who are thought most appropriate for an upward departure, that they have far more time, either by consecutive or by upward departure, than they would have under the mandatory minimum. And I have imposed such sentences. I think it's clear that the most dangerous of the most dangerous are subject to ballot measure 11 minimum sentences and enhanced sentences, particularly by way of consecutive sentencing, some of which may be vulnerable to the Blakely argument. As to the financial impact of this, and my colleagues from the department that has an official position to share with you, this is mine, there's two things about this. First of all, we're going to spend a great deal of money litigating at the trial level 30, 100, 150 times whether judges have the authority you can give them right now and intend to give them in the future. Why do we have to litigate about whether you wanted us to have it meanwhile, when it seems to me you clearly do, unless there's some overriding fiscal argument? And the fiscal argument is misleading. If we have 100 trials to do, fine. That's 100 juries. This is a finite piece. Of course it's going to be a burden if we have 100 trials coming through the system. But unlike everything else you're asked to do, which is, let's do it this way from now on, and maybe some set it and re-examine it, this we know to be a finite piece. And yes, it will be reduced by those defendants who will negotiate something in between rather than face with a more likely upward sentence on remand. So we're not going to have all those trials. But here's another point. Most of these folks, if we're doing our job when we sentence them, are persistent offenders. If they get out after half the sentence that they got because we don't do retroactivity and somebody concludes that we needed a specific legislative authority, they'll be back generating new demands for new jury trials if we're doing our job. And you will have far more jury trials to pay for because people got out early if we're doing our job at sentencing. Let me just close by saying this important qualification. You have heard me say before, and I'll say it again, that we're not doing as careful a job as we should, because upward departures are not expressly focused on public safety or crime reduction. The whole system of the guidelines, with the exception of dangerous offender and sexually violent dangerous offender, which actually has some attention to, let me call it science, but careful attention to future risk, outside those areas, we don't spend the kind of attention on risk that we should. I wish that I could have more passion for these upward departures than I do, because I know that they're not precisely aimed at the most dangerous offenders in any kind of rigorous sense. Nonetheless, they are the more dangerous offenders. They are far more likely to commit new crimes when they come back. If you deprive them of jury now, you'll get them a jury later. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You know, we had testimony earlier that the most likely outcome would be that sentences would actually end up a little shorter second time around through the negotiation process on remand. This is if it's retroactive. Can you see a scenario where a sentence might actually turn out, an enhanced sentence might turn out to be longer? And if so, would that be an ex post facto problem?
Two things, Senator Chair, members of the committee. My recollection of the law is that it's pretty damn clear that once you appeal a sentence and you succeed, you can't receive a stronger sentence than you appealed. I think even the prosecution type attorney generals here would nod their heads in agreement.
Just checking.
Yeah, they're all crying back there. Okay. All right. Well, that answers that. Senator Whitsitt?
Chair Buttigieg, Judge Marcus, did I understand your testimony to state that a statute requiring or allowing retroactive sentencing enhancement would somehow influence the Oregon Supreme Court's decision on the actual constitutionality of such a policy?
That's not my position. Here's what I think. And this was really generated by a thought by Jean Quinn about what about the people who are on remand who've already been resentenced before the effective date of this bill with an emergency clause. and I don't think it would affect the Supreme Court's opinion on the constitutionality of anything, but I think it might affect the Supreme Court's ability to derive what legislative intent was if, as early as you could, you adopted a provision which said, yeah, you can fix Blakely, please go ahead and do it. The Supreme Court of the United States says have juries, have juries. If you don't say that, then maybe for this little bubble, you have a different issue. So no, I didn't, Senator Woods, that I did not say and don't believe that anything you do will affect the Supreme Court's position on constitutionality.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm glad you clarified that because I kind of heard it the same way, and I knew that wasn't the case, but I'm glad you cleared that up. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you. Ms. Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nancy Miller. I'm the Deputy State Court Administrator for Program Operations for the Judicial Department. And as Judge Marcus said, I am here today only to give you a few brief nuggets of information about the department's position. I do want to acknowledge that Ms. Quinn did all the work on this and is the detail expert, so she is here in case you have any specific questions. The department is neutral on the issue of retroactivity because we believe it's a public policy decision, albeit a very difficult one, that the Legislative Assembly is faced with making. Just as Judge Marcus said, this is the legislature's opportunity to fix this, and it is your decision how you do it. As to the fiscal impact of the bill, this has been really ticklish and difficult for us because, as you know, the fiscal impact was created by the Blakely decision. So to the extent that the bill implements the decision, the fiscal impact attaches to the bill, but it is the decision that is creating the impact. I'd like to just briefly address Mr. French's comments first. With great respect for his 24 years of experience, I'm not sure how he can predict the behavior of all the deputy DAs, the prosecutors, and judges all across the state. Respectfully, he's speaking for us with a confidence that we do not feel. Consider the number of times you've heard the word if today, and that's what we've been struggling with. If the Supreme Court does this, if a judge does that, if somebody else does this. For example, the consecutive sentence decision alone could bring hundreds of cases. It could bring zero. It's an if. You can certainly also see that there's a significant difference of opinion between the defense and the prosecution. Assuming the differences will be negotiated might be the same as assuming the prosecution and defense will agree here today. I don't think that's going to happen. Now, in the real world, there's obviously a lot more incentive in actual cases to negotiate, but I don't think we can assume at this point how many will be negotiated and how many will go for resentencing and will need to impanel a new jury. It all depends on the word we heard today, if, and any number of clauses can follow that. The uncertainty places us in a position of having to say we just cannot predict the impact. What we do know, and we've done our best guesses, if you will, estimates, based on what we know to date, if a new jury is impaneled on 16 to 25 of the cases, these are assumptions, so I want to be very clear, these are assumptions. If a new jury is impaneled on 16 to 25 of the cases, and now we're hearing there are 30 out there now and potentially another 120 that are up, and if that resentencing took 2 days to 3 days, so these are lengthy estimates, we would exceed the $50,000 threshold. That's the sum total of what we can tell you. You can plug in any other numbers to that. If it's 50 cases and they take 10 minutes, if it's, we know the cost for the judge time, we know the cost for the clerk time, we know the cost for the interpreter time, so you're probably in the same position as we are trying to figure out which numbers you plug in there. So that's basically
it. Like you say, it's the Blakely decision that caused the problem, so mm-hmm. Our consciences are clear.
Yeah. Thank you very little, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Very good. Are there any questions from the committee? Thank you. Did you want to say anything, Jim? Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate everybody spending the time on this. We found out one tweak we're going to have to make on these amendments. Before we go, I'll get around to the committee members to find out what the sentiment is on retroactive versus not retroactive. It's been a great discussion. I really appreciate it. So we will close the hearing on this bill, and we will move to a brief public hearing, I think, on Senate Bill 1050.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1050 comes to you from the Committee on Rules, and what it does is it modifies the eligibility for child support and requirements of a child attending school that is a child 18 years of age or older and under the 21 years of age to require the child may make satisfactory progress as defined by the school rather than maintain a C average. It has some other issues, too. There are several people here to testify. I know Renee Schenko is here in her office, and I think there's a sign-up list, too.
Okay, we have a sign-up list buried here somewhere, but Senator Brown wanted to speak on this, and I'm wondering if anyone knows. Dale, maybe you could call down to Senator Brown's office and see if she's...
Here they come.
There they are. They were watching on TV the whole time.
They ran the whole way, except she's not out of breath.
You made it here in record time. Thank you.
Amendments in front of you, and there will be an additional change that will be needed to the Dash 2 amendment.
This is a public hearing only today, committee. Welcome.
Madam Chair, Senators, for the record, my name is Hans Bernard. I'm Senator Brown's legislative assistant. Today before you, we have Senate Bill 1050. Senate Bill 1050 deals with the child attending school laws, and it came to our attention from some constituent cases, one being from Celia Nunez, who works in our office. And we have worked extensively with several organizations on this bill, feel that we have consensus. There are a couple of minor tweaks that need to be made in terms of a Dash 3 amendment. But here today we have several people who can outline sort of the way we got to the bill and why we believe it's good policy. If you have questions, we have several folks here who can answer them.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
I also have a letter from Judge Raines that I would like to read into the record at this point, Madam Chair.
Okay. Is it very long?
A couple paragraphs quickly.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, dear Senate Judiciary Committee, thank you for allowing me to provide testimony by letter. I have a mass docket of support contempt cases tomorrow, and none of the other judges are available to do it. I have practiced law since 1976 and have practiced family law nearly exclusively since 1981. I am on the family law team of judges in Washington County serving my second two-year rotation. ORS 107.108 has been a problem statute since its inception. I have no quarrel with the philosophy behind it, but only the application because of the statute's unclear language. I have seen widely disparate approaches and results from various judges contending with the ambiguities. I have heard practitioners and judges complain vigorously about the statute, so I have been plugging away at a revision statute. I presented my proposal to the Family and Juvenile Law Judges Committee of the Oregon Judges Conference after circulating it to the OFLAT members and presenting preliminary ideas and a number of CLE classes for family law lawyers. The proposal was endorsed by the Judges Committee. Shane Fuller of the Oregon Department of Justice Child Support Division has presented with me at one CLE put on by the Oregon Academy of Family Law Practitioners. Wherever we have gone, both judges and lawyers have praised the efforts to amend the statute and endorse the ideas presented. Senate Bill 1050 deals with the crucial issues which need resolution for the families who have or may have a child attending school. It clarifies expectations of the obligee, the obligor, and the courts. While it is different from the original proposal, it nonetheless effectively accomplishes what needs to be done. I fully support the bill with the current Dash 2 amendments. I urge you to support Senate Bill 1050. Please feel free to call upon me as you see fit. Thank you for your consideration. Honorable Keith R. Raines, Circuit Court Judge.
Thank you for reading that into the record. Are there questions from the committee? Okay, Ronell.
For the record, Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I'm Ronell Schenkel with the Attorney General's Office. I will be very brief. You have a copy of my written testimony in front of you. it does lay out the role of the Attorney General in the Department of Justice, which I believe you are familiar with, so I will not repeat that since you have it in writing. Briefly, the child attending school laws have been in Oregon law since 1973. This comes up each session as a topic of discussion, but the last serious debate was in 1997. Three of the members of your committee happened to be representatives in the House at that time and will probably remember that last debate. We are here today finally with a comprehensive update to this area of law, and as Hans has already mentioned and in Judge Rain's letter, it is mostly to clarify parts of the process that we continue to have debate and inconsistency in practice over. In my testimony, there are also some statistical information about the current status of other states and where Oregon is with regard to how many of us still maintain child attending school laws. There's also information about the current caseload in Oregon's child support program. Again, briefly, our goal here today is not to discuss the underlying policy issue of this law, but to bring to you information that will improve and clarify the processes both for the citizens, the families, the practitioners, and the child support program. We've been happy to work with Senator Brown's staff, two of the members who are here beside me, as well as the Oregon Law Center, the district attorneys, and I might mention that I also provided you with written testimony from Conchetta Schlesinger, who is the Oregon District Attorneys Association Child Support Liaison. She is in the room and available if you need her, but in the interest of time, we just passed out her testimony. We have also shared this information with the Oregon Judicial Department, who is neutral, but also have members in the room, as you are aware, and we have shared with several members of the state bar and several circuit court judges. So we have done a lot of outreach on this bill, and we think we have a good product for you to consider.
Thank you very much. Cecilia, did
yes.
you want to say anything?
Yes. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Celia Nunez. I work as a policy analyst for the Senate Majority Office, and I'm here on my own time to testify in support of 1050. During the interim, our Senate Majority Office was contacted by the Oregon Academy of Family Law Practitioners. They were seeking legislative support to amend the Oregon laws related to child attending school. The organization had held discussions, completed an email outreach, and shared those comments with our office. Subsequently, Senator Brown held ad hoc meetings with members of the Department of Justice, both staff from the Attorney General's Office and from the Child Support Program, as well as a representative from the Oregon Law Center. As an additional note, I've had personal experience with the child attending school laws. My divorce decree contains the child attending school provisions. I'd like to briefly share my experience. My son began attending college on September 20th of 2004, and while in the process of completing the child attending school compliance form at the beginning of the fall term, he unfortunately received correspondence in early October from the child support program, which led him to believe that he was in compliance, later to discover that he was not. Without our knowledge, my ex-spouse had filed an objection alleging our son was not attending school, therefore was not qualified under the child attending school laws. Regretfully, what my son believed to be a notification from the child support program as a document stating he was in compliance with the confirmation of qualification specific to the previous challenge, which my son was unaware of. What my son did not realize was that although he received this form stating you are in compliance in error, he still needed to complete additional paperwork for the new term in college as requested per statute. Though my son was in compliance, attending school, and was in fact qualified to receive support, he had missed the deadline and was terminated from support. He could not be reinstated without legal representation. Fortunately, the child support program is working to improve the clarity of these forms, and I'm certain they will make the necessary improvements. The real issue at hand was that through this experience, I learned that the child support program does not have the authority to reinstate child support, even though we could provide the necessary documentation and would have done so previously. Our only option was to go to court in order for a judge to reinstate the support. Unfortunately, my ex-spouse has continued to fight this on the technicality of the law. In addition, I've had to incur the expense of hiring an attorney to assist us throughout this process. I tell you my personal story because it demonstrates to us that while the intentions of the courts, the practitioners, and most importantly, the child support program are well-intended, the law in this area is simply not clear.
This confirmed what others had been saying to our office. This is an important area of law for families which needs to be clarified in Oregon statutes. The draft you have before you today, along with the amendments, comes from much hard work by my coworkers and by the Child Support Program. Additionally, the Child Support Program staff has the expertise in this area, has handled the outreach for us with the Oregon Law Center, the Oregon State Bar, the Oregon Judicial Department, Oregon State Higher Education, Oregon Department of Education, as well as other constituent groups. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I thank you for your time. I appreciate you listening to my personal story and urge you to pass Senate Bill 1050 to help the children of Oregon and to give more clarity to the child support program. At this time, I'll answer any questions if you should have any. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much, Celia.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Shani Fuller, and I am with the Department of Justice Oregon Child Support Program. You have my written testimony in front of you. I was going to walk you through the bill today as the Dash 2 amendments, and reading that along with the bill are fairly confusing. However, as stated, we will have Dash 3 amendments, which address an issue that was brought up by Oregon University Systems to addressing federal compliance issues. It's with the written consent. We are confident that we can get to some language to fix that. However, I would ask for your direction, Chair Burdick, and whether you would like me to walk through the bill or whether you would like to rely on my written testimony.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate the written testimony. I think we'll hold up on a more thorough discussion. I appreciate you moving rapidly through this. We knew we were going to have a time constraint, and we did, so I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Are there questions from the committee?
I'm just saving the next hearing.
Okay, we can hardly wait. Thank you very much. We have Karen Berkowitz signed up.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Karen Berkowitz from the Oregon Law Center. I'm an attorney there, and as you probably know, the Oregon Law Center represents low-income Oregonians. Over the last few years, we've seen a number of cases involving children that are attending school, and the problem that we've seen is the lack of a process to get the support enforcement and the support reinstated. This bill solves that problem for our clients. We've also encountered situations where a child is attending school in a GED program where they don't give letter grades. There's just an expectation that they take exams and make satisfactory progress that way. This bill also resolves that problem by letting the school define what satisfactory progress is. It gives the child that's 18 to 21 years old standing in any judicial proceeding. It also makes a lot of headway in terms of administrative proceedings. Now, there are some issues that are not quite resolved by the bill, but DCS and the Oregon Law Center have agreed to work on these issues through the rulemaking process and through some work groups. Specifically, there's a need to define legal proceedings, which legal proceedings the child will participate in, and it's our hope that the rights of the child attending school will be substantially similar to the rights of any other child support obligee where there is a support order for the child attending school or the need for one. Furthermore, we have some questions about the access to child support information, and DCS has committed to do some rulemaking around this to assure that the child has access to necessary child support information. Furthermore, there's a question about what services DCS will provide to 18 to 21-year-olds, particularly if there's no support order in existence at the time that the child turns 18. In other words, the family breaks up when the child is 18 or 19 years old. And again, there's going to be a work group. We have confidence that we can resolve these issues as we've been working with them for probably over 15 years. We've never had a problem yet. We want to thank DCS and the other people who participated in this bill for working so cooperatively and for what I think is a very good product for our clients. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions, Council?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ms. Berkowitz, are you seeking an amendment to the current bill?
No, we're not. We're just clarifying that there will be some rulemaking needed to flesh out some of these terms.
Thank you.
Thank you for putting that on the record. Any other questions? Thank you. Close the hearing on Senate Bill 1050. Senate Judiciary is adjourned.